Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel. Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Ba-da-ba-ba-da, ba-ba-da-ba-da-da. You know what that is, Russ? Da-da-da-da. You know what theme song that is? Da-da-da-da-da. It was the start of a big show, a huge nightly show. Here's Rusty. Hey, folks, another episode of The Suspendables with me, Jungle Jim Jerome, and, of course, 17-year...
16, idiot
in the NHL and Russ Cortinel. You know what I keep forgetting, Russ, and all of our Canadian listeners who are our age, okay, upwards of, let's say, 45, that Rusty and Jerome were the two big characters on The Friendly Giant. You remember? did you ever watch The Friendly Giant?
When I you were did. A kid?
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah. Yeah. I was the Jerome the Giraffe and Rusty the Rooster.
Copyrights.
Yeah, there we go. How are you doing, Rusty? How was the week?
I'm doing good. Enjoying my stay here at Gosser and playing a little bit of golf, hanging out with my son, staying with Pat the Bat for a couple days.
Very good. Yeah, we had Pat on. Pat Squirrel. You say it like squirrel. Burl.
Yeah.
Pat Burl. A great interview we did with him a couple shows back if you want to listen to that. Speaking of your son, of course, we've got a lot and watch going with his career. What's happening with him hockey-wise, Russ, to keep up his game?
Well, he's been talking to Jeff Jackson, his agent, and a couple teams have been talking to Jeff. And it's just, you know, at least they're talking. There was a period there where we didn't know what was going to happen. So all these young hockey players in the same position are waiting to see what's going to happen next year, when they might start. Lawton's been up here for a week or so. He came back from Michigan and he's been able to talk to Wayne, Mr. Gretzky, and he talked to Doug Waite last night. And so he's in a good environment to get some information of, you know, from what they know. And he's just trying to be positive and doesn't know where he's going or where he's playing, but at least there's conversation.
Yeah, he's done his degree, right? He's finished in college. And
he graduated this year, so he's done with school and he can focus on hockey and hopefully he can play somewhere next year.
How much weight, Russ, when a team or the league is starting to look at kids, we still call your son a kid, who are draftable. Would any weight come into it, Russ, that you were an NHLer and they're going, you know what, he comes from good genes, man, when making that decision? I mean, you're probably biased, but...
No, I think there is. I think there definitely... It does help. His uncle played, I played. You look across the board from my era, a lot of kids from NHL players are playing in the NHL. They grew up in the environment. They've been in around teams if they were old enough when the dads played. They get to, you know, listen to the experience of their fathers that played in the NHL. So it definitely helps. But you still have to be good enough to get to play. And so it can only take you so far. Pat the Bat just walked in.
Oh, yay, Pat. Yes.
Yeah, he just had a tooth. He's got a post put in, so he's in a little bit of pain. I was going to barbecue some steaks for us tonight, but I think I'm making him porridge.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there we go. Tell Pat the award-winning interview he did with us, but all the comments we got going, we love Pat jumping on a guy's back naked when he came out of the shower to fight off a media guy. That was the best. On the show today, we're going to talk about number three. Of course, playoffs are here. I never thought it would happen. I really didn't with the NHL, with COVID. You talked to one of the players. We're going to get your or his reaction to what he told you. Lars Eller's, who's with Washington, he's got some comments about it that will perhaps surprise you. Rusty, I found your number one friend, who changed his name. Moishi, I forget his last name. He was changed his name to Russ because he was your number one fan, and he's got a great way of telling stories. And I got on the phone with him for about 10 or 15 minutes. And had some wonderful things to say about you, but an incredible scam that this guy pulled off to get into the dressing room during the Stanley Cup Finals, World Series.
I'd never heard that story. That's funny.
Yeah, hilarious interview. And he talks about you were the nicest guy to him. He was a stalker fan. Boy, you opened up your arms to this guy. And anyway, we talked to him, which was great. We got a bunch of questions from listeners. Thanks a lot to Matrix and a bunch of other guys who weighed in on this thing. And then our first topic, Russ, we've talked about this before. I guess we'll address it. Someone, Matt Dumba, took a knee during one of the games, in support of Black Lives Matter. Lots of people support it, but there's lots of people Russ have come in and said, okay, we're okay with the issue. We're okay with people having an opinion. We're okay with people taking a stance on it. But I don't think they should be using sports to highlight it or use that as a platform for them to give their personal view or stand on it. And someone's asked me to ask you about that in an email and want your thoughts on all that.
Well, my last year I weighed in on this with the football, and I said I didn't agree that they were kneeling and during the anthem. And I thought that they all have a platform because they're famous and they're, you know, whether you're an athlete or any kind of celebrity, you have a platform, and I felt like they could do it differently. And then what's transpired over the last, 6 months with what we've seen from video, I think Will Smith said it best, racism and brutality is now being videotaped and played for everyone to see on social media for the first time. You know, now my opinion on it has changed that I wouldn't want my son to kneel. I wouldn't, but at what point do we start listening, and at what time do we start changing? Now, listen, 99 or 95% or whatever you want to say about police officers are great people, and they're trying to do their job. And like anything, there's bad people in whatever walk of life. And we've seen some bad people do some freaking horrific things, and there's been cover-ups for years, and I just think it needs to freaking end. And, our son, every time he's driving in his car, we're worried about him getting pulled over and how he's going to be treated. Yeah. You get the wrong person who's a racist, who's a bad person, and he pulls over my kid, I'm worried.
Right.
We all get pulled over. We've all been pulled over by police, unless you take the bus. And don't drive, you've been probably pulled over, and it's nerve-wracking no matter who you are. Do I have my registration? Do I have my insurance? Is my license up to date? Was I speeding? Was I not speeding? And it's not a great feeling. And anyone who's been pulled over and doesn't care, I don't know who you are, because anyone I know who's been pulled over by a police officer, now you throw in your minority,
right?
And it's even worse. And so I just, I don't agree with the freaking looting and the burning of businesses down, but the peaceful protests, I'm all for. My family went in LA and they peacefully protested, but we need to address this, and we need to address it now.
Right. You can probably figure out by now, if you don't know, your background, Russ, you're married to Paris. who's black. So your kids are mixed. And so that'll just, it's a different world. I'm of the opinion, Russ, I don't think they should be using sports. You made that point with Kaepernick back in the day. You said, you know, I agree with you. Like, if it's going to be a negative connotation, then let's not do it. You know, if you're going to be, you know, protesting something at a sporting event as an athlete, I don't like that. I like, you had taught me that a year ago, saying, look at, the guy should have gone to the team and said, look at, okay, we got it. We don't want this to be a distraction. We want to certainly recognize it. But how can we do it in a positive manner? And, you know, when I go to Starbucks, Russ, I you know, when I get my coffee, I don't want to listen to the guy giving me my coffee, his stance, before I can get, you know, on it. I don't want a store clerk to give it to me. You know, when I go to the gym, I'm, you know, very rarely, but when I do, I just want to run on my treadmill. The point I'm making is, you know, when I watching hockey games now, I want to watch the game. I want to get some relief from what's going on from COVID and the stress of having kids and everything else and jobs and all that. So I guess if I had to pick, I don't want them to use it as a platform for it.
I agree with you. And I thought it was beautiful that the NHL players had that ring, you know, the circle for the anthem. They're all standing. And I thought that was great. You know, they're bringing attention. And then, you know, last night we had what, 3 or 4 players in the Dallas game that kneeled. And I've said this before, my dad, on Saturday nights, we were allowed to eat in front of the television in Victoria, British Columbia, watch hockey night in Canada. Mm-hmm. And my dad had us stand for the anthem. And I played for Canada at every level. Mm-hmm. So I'm a proud Canadian, and I just couldn't imagine ever doing that. But it's the message, it's what they're talking about that I'm 100% behind. I just wish that they wouldn't kneel. And
right.
I just don't, I don't agree with all the, I agree with the protesting and not the looting. And and burning down of buildings and all that and businesses. I do not agree with that. But the message that these young people and older people are fed up with how they've been treated in private life, in public life. And, you know, we need to end it.
Right. Sad to say. It's obvious to you and it's obvious to me that burning buildings down and looting is not the way to go. But it's sad to say, Russ, not everyone agrees. Not everyone. They're like, have at her, baby. Have at her. And I think we're into a lot of trouble if that keeps going that way. And anyway, we wanted to address that. And that's about as serious as we like to get. The hockey season, Rusty, is underway. I never thought they'd be able to pull it off. The NHL, baseball seems to be having trouble here. It seems to crumble here. I see a lot of postponements on games when I look at trying to get scores. Don't know if that'll be able to pick itself up, but I think hockey's going to be able to do it, Russ. The games are well underway. We're already 2 games deep in the playoffs. What do you think? I never thought they'd be able to do it. What do you think?
Yeah, I didn't either. And I talked to Lars Eller's today from Washington. And he says they're all very surprised. There's lots to do. They're having fun and they're, you know, to me, the games look good on TV. I mean, they look good for how early we are into the playoffs and, you know, so far so good, but they're enjoying the bubble. I talked to Alex Steen also, and he made a crack. It was pretty funny. He's a member of Gosser, and I had a call with him about his property. And he said, yeah, I got to go, Russ. I got an hour and a half of yard time. He's got a great sense of humor. But there's 2 guys that I've talked to that are, they're saying it's fine. So, yeah, I think the longer it goes and the guys with families that they don't see their families, that's going to be tough. But so far, so good.
Right on. Okay, let's pick this up. Rusty, the games are underway. The NHL is going to survive this, it looks like. I hope it doesn't get any worse. They've credit to them because baseball's gone for shit. I don't know if they're going to be able to continue playing baseball because there's a bunch of cases, COVID, that's happening. What'd you think? First of all, Rusty, you probably watched a bit of the games. That's a great comment from Lars Eller that they love it. That's totally interesting. They got no problem. The games that you have watched, Russ, or portions of them, do you think anything's been affected or are the games affected by this COVID with no fans? Do you like the style of play? Does it remind you of the days that you played playoff hockey?
I think for us fans watching the game, it's a good experience with no fans in the seats. And what they did with, you know, with covering the seats, they've done a great job because visually it looks really good from a TV spectator. And I've been around, like, in the mornings at Gosser, we have breakfast. It's Ray Whitney, Brandon Morrow, Wayne Gretzky, Kelly Chase, myself. And we talk about the games and everybody agrees that visually it looks really good for us fans that are watching on TV. The games, I think a couple games we thought could have been a little more physical for playoff hockey, but it's early. I think that that'll pick up. Obviously, when you first start playing, you want to get your legs underneath you, your body gets used to getting bumped. It usually, you know, that's training camp where you're starting to get hit again. You've been off. And so maybe they're just feeling each other out and the physicality of the games will pick up. But all of us think that it looks good so far, other than a couple of games where it looked like, you know, no hitters.
Right. Right. No hitters. Yeah. Russ, playoffs to me is fantastic. It's great. But I the worst side of playoffs for me is it brings out the stupidest comments from fans. It just drives me bananas. Your Leafs, okay, lose 2-0 in the first game, and people torch them, Russ.
Yeah.
They absolutely I saw a post from a guy going, you know, you disgusting pigs. It was just, the language was so heavy. You know, F you, Leafs, I'm giving up on you. Nobody tried. Austin Matthews, you piece of shit. On and on and on. And it made me think, that just drives me nuts. Because they're going to turn around, they're going to win a game, and the same fan, where are you now? Where are you now, right? With your stupid ass heavy opinion. Take us inside the room a little bit, Russ. Some of that does happen, you know, that players, for whatever reason, you know, don't have the game they should. But further, it looks like they didn't have the game they should because their effort wasn't there. That's a real deal, Russ, isn't it? In playoffs, it does happen. Take us inside the room, Russ, when guys have shitty games, and maybe let's say you didn't think their effort was very good, Russ. What happens inside the room to this guy? Is something said to him? Is it handled during periods or what?
No, I mean, coaches will call a player in and go over his game and talk to him about what he's doing, what he's not doing. I think when you get to this level, the pressure that each player puts on themselves is immense, and the pride they have for themselves and their game, they're going to bounce back with an effort. And then sometimes it's just confidence where guys lose confidence. And then sometimes you just can't get that back depending on the player. And then, you know, it just gets worse and worse. And then some players just step up and play great and they get a bigger role. And that player who had the role slides back. And there's a lot of factors, but usually the player himself doesn't need to be told. And then the media usually does a really good job of beating the shit out of that person. So you'll have a coach that takes you aside and go, look, we know how good you are. You got to get back to these things that make you great or make you good. Focus on those things. We believe in you. We're behind you. Get out there and play the way we know you can. And then if it happens again, then the coach probably says, holy shit, something's going on here. He's injured. He's lost his confidence. And now I got to think about, okay, this is short term here. We can't have a guy have a 10 game, you know, 10 bad games during the season. You can let a player slide because you've got games to make up, but in the playoffs it's do or die. And you know, a goalie is a great example. If the goalie's off for one or two games, you got to change. You got to put somebody else in because you got two.
Right.
Forwards, you know, you got four left wingers, four right wingers, four centermen. You can shake them up a bit, but
yeah,
I think it's behind closed doors where a guy will call you in, a coach will call you in and give it to you, but
players don't say anything then.
Yeah. Players are the first guys to pat you on the shin pads and say, okay, let's go. That's what most players say is like, we freaking need you.
Right.
Not you, you know, they're not ripping a guy.
Right.
So that's up to the coach to do that, not a player. Let's go back to where you said earlier in the show that you run on the treadmill.
Yeah.
Where is the smoking treadmill gym in freaking Edmonton?
As soon as I get off, pal, right to the car. And I told you, I'm an exhibition.
Jimmy, you're the only guy I know who runs behind traffic and freaking breathe in fumes.
Yeah, exactly. I could do it. Yeah. I'm an exhibit at the gym. The guy that says, watch him go now into the car, sweating like a pig and fire up the dart. This is going to be a two White Claw show for sure. I picked a bad decade to give up drinking.
A reminder, the Suspendables are engaged on Facebook. Your comments are welcome always.
Rusty, my boy, we got a question from Kevin. Let's call him Kevin. When we watch the games, Russ, and I've always thought this too, that's why I want to bring it up. We see a lot of coaches rant, man, during a game. Like there's two or three or four behind the bench. They flash the camera up into the press box and there'll be two or three guys there from a team with the headsets going on. What happens during a game, Russ, with the roles of all these coaches when a game is going on? Why are there two other guys on the bench with the head coach during a game? What are they doing?
Well, when I played, we had three coaches. So we had one for the defense and one with the forwards, and then the coach was running the bench. And then they started adding coaches, and then the headset came into play, and they're up in the sky looking down, talking to, you know, and then video. Now you've got freaking computers with replays. I mean, there's so much going on, but it's unbelievable. I went to a practice last year and I think I saw seven coaches on the ice skating around, you know, goalie coach. And I'm like, holy shit, how many guys do you need? And it's hard for me to answer that because I come from an era where we had three coaches and we had a goalie coach that came out once in a while. So I guess we had four, but that goalie coach was, you know, he didn't have an impact on anything other than he practice. He worked with the goalies after practice or before. I don't know. I think, you know, sometimes less is more.
Like, what are guys doing up in the booth? Like, fuck. What are they going to do?
Yeah, I don't know. Other than I answer that question with any authority. And if I ran a team, there wouldn't be too many people up in the freaking upstairs telling us what to do.
And the head coach, Russ, is just calling line changes, isn't he, and stuff? Like when the games, once the puck's dropped?
The best was Pat Burns in Montreal. And we had our trainer off to the side. And he would watch the other team's bench and he would tell Pat who was up, who on the visiting team was up.
Right.
So he could hear the coach saying, okay, you know, Dougie, you're up. And then he'd go, Gilmore's up. And then Burns would know who to put up. Again, because we were all matching lines.
Right.
Other than matching lines and I don't know. They've made the game more difficult, I think, than it is. But you know what? I don't coach in the NHL, and maybe I'm totally wrong, but it seems all too confusing. There's too many
bosses.
Let's
see, Rusty. Let's go to some of our questions. Both your teams are in it, the Habs and and the Leafs. Some of this you've probably covered before, but one guy wants to know your most favorite moment as a Hab and your most favorite moment as a Toronto Maple Leaf.
Oh boy. Just the whole experience, even though we were a young team. When I first got there, we were an older team. We transitioned to a younger team, which you'd call today a rebuild.
Right.
played with some great young players my age that went on to have great careers, whether in Toronto or elsewhere. A lot of fun. Your first team, you're so excited to play on your first team. Everybody wants to stay on that team and retire playing for that team. And for most of us, it doesn't happen. But being a Maple Leafs fan, my dad's favorite team, getting drafted there and playing, having some success, led the team in points one year.
Nice.
We had some playoff success for a weak team, young team. We won a couple rounds, nothing crazy, but back then it was really difficult to, there was only two or three teams that probably had a shot every year to win the Stanley Cup, unlike today. So making the playoffs and then winning a round or two was tough. And, we did that and then going to Montreal, not being a Habs fan. And we all know in Canada what that's like. You're right. Either a Maple Leaf fan or a Montreal fan or whatever. That was interesting, but I absolutely enjoyed most of my time in Montreal. It's a fabulous place to play when you're doing well, the team's doing well, it's fantastic. And the fans are unbelievable. They're super passionate, just like the Maple Leaf fans are. And now most of the country love their team. So there's passion throughout each team. But, you know, in the early days, it was, you know, before Edmonton and Calgary, it was, you were either a Leafs fan or a Habs fan a long time ago. So to play in those two cities was—it's just so special. Even though I left Montreal on a negative note, really enjoyed playing there and having that experience.
Not all the memories are positive ones. You know, when you talk about Montreal, and just refresh us, Russ, on that one again. About I know in past shows you've said it was one of the only regrets you had as an NHL player.
Well, I had, everything was going great. My career, my first 3 years there was freaking awesome. And then I, after I led the team in scoring my third year, I signed up at the time, a big deal. I was the 20th highest paid player in the league for a second. And it literally like a second. Right. And then I tore my rotator cuff in a warm up.
Ouch.
Yeah, my own player tripped me into the boards, tore my rotator cuff, and I ended up missing 41 games that year. And they misdiagnosed me, and the media got on me because of my contract, and then it just went downhill from there. So I'll skip all the other stuff, but at the end of the year, I asked to be traded, and I went public with it in the media, and that was a mistake, and a huge mistake for me, and I paid a price for it. And Serge Savard ended up trading me, which I asked for. I wanted to go to LA and he traded me to Minneapolis. And, you know, I finished off the rest of my career. But it was the first 3 years where it was bliss. It was, you know, for an English kid from Victoria playing in Montreal. It was great. And each year I got better and better and better. And then I had that really bad injury with the misdiagnosis. And then I missed even more time than I probably should have. And then it just, when you're injured like that, you have a lot of time on your hands to think about other things. And I was like, I just met my wife who is an actress. And I thought, you know, get me out of here so I can be in LA and she can do her thing and I can play hockey. And it was one of those young, dumb things that you look back on and wish you had handled differently. And I that's where I say to people, that's when you really need a father in your life.
Right.
And I had a stepdad, but I didn't have my dad. And I think if I had him in my life, I would have got way better advice than listening to myself at 25 years old or 26, whatever I was at the time.
Right.
And you play, you know, I started when I was 18, and at that time I thought I was midway through my career. You think, you know, you've been doing something for so long and you've experienced so many things, but you're still a young person and
right.
And making what adult decisions when you're really not really an adult yet.
Yeah. Well, it's true.
It was a screw up, and I feel bad because I love Sir Savard. He was great to me, and it just was not good. It was bad.
You talk about fathers, which I love my dad. He died a long time ago now in 2005. But he was, like you speak about your stepfather too, and your own father, how much guidance they provided. And I always, someone, you know, it's hard to put in words, right? What a father figure means to you. But the best thing I ever said about my dad was, this is how great a guy he was. He hated fishing. Okay. He absolutely despised fishing, and he took us fishing every August for a week, you know, and I would have never got through. You bring that up about father, you know, I don't know if you knew this or not, but I had a brother, my younger brother was tragically killed when he was 21, and I could not make heads or tails of it. I couldn't make sense. And if it wasn't for my dad, you know, pulling me aside and saying, look, here's how we're going to get through this. And, I would have never got through it. You know, I would have never got through it. So.
I've faced some tragedies in my life. My dad died he committed suicide when I was 13, and I made every decision for myself after my dad passed. And my mom said, whatever decision you make, I'll back you on it. And that was it. A 13-year-old boy, you know, making decisions. I went to Notre Dame at 14. That was my decision, not her. She didn't want me to go, and I went. Playing junior hockey instead of going to college. That was my decision. My decision was to, you know, buy my first house, buy my first car. I never asked permission for any of it. And then when I made this mistake, it was on me and I own it. And, you know, guys who I played with, they were like shaking their head going, what's he doing? You know, and why is he saying these things? And it was just me. It was, you know, I was not getting advice. I didn't talk to my agent about it. I didn't talk to my mom or my stepdad about it. Everything I did, they found out after the fact. And a lot of the decisions I made were really, really good. But, a couple were freaking horrible. You know, I had an argument with Pat Burns in the basement in the locker room in Chicago, and I called him a fat fuck 10 times in an argument. And it was the wrong thing to do. Like Sir Savard, he freaking set me straight after. He goes, you know what? You don't like your boss. I don't like my boss. I can't go into his office and tell him to go, you know, go stick this up your ass. When you work for somebody, you've got to, you know, you've got to toe the line, and you can't speak to somebody like that. And I had to go back and apologize to Pat Burns, and I was sorry. I was just so freaking mad at him, and he was so freaking mad at me that my emotions got the best of me, and I didn't handle it correctly. And so, you know, you learn from those things. I'm still learning. I'm 55. I learn every day. I try to be the best person I can. I try to make the best decisions I can. And what's different now is that it affects my family. So I have to think about them, how, you know, what I do and I don't. And so anyway, sorry to get heavy on you.
No, it's great. So you had no one to lean on, Russ? Like, I mean, your father died so young. Was there any go-to person for you? Most of us didn't go through what you did with losing our father at such a young age. So we always had a parent or two to lean on. And you had nobody through all that time, did you?
So I had a great teacher, Phil Ridley at Notre Dame. He was my ninth grade teacher, and he was a big help for me. And then, our family, like when... it was unbelievable when my dad died. It was such like, you know, like closed a chapter in your life. And then we moved on. We never talked about him. And it was just, and so I guess that just carried with me that I just, managed, I just started managing my own life. Mm-hmm.
And a good life you have, man. Good.
Yeah,
for you.
No, I can't complain about it at all. I just think that it just, that's how I've, you know, for the last, 42 years, you've pretty much been running my own show, you know, and now, you know, obviously Paris and I are been married a long time, but even she sometimes shakes her head like, we're doing what? You did what?
We got Rusty. This is kind of funny. One of my favorite chirps in hockey, which we've talked about a lot, was a guy who had just like the slowest slap shot ever. And the guy always said, yeah, when he takes a slap shot, we get a delay of game penalty. Okay. I think it's Rick here who said, you know, there's guys on your teams, that have had, you know, players that other players joke about in regards to who has the worst shot, who can't line up a check properly, or who can't skate fast enough. Surely that exists at all levels, including the NHL. I'd love to hear from Russ who's players that got ribbed the most when they, you know, couldn't skate very fast or had a bad shot or missing checks all the time. So I said, okay, I'll ask Rusty that.
Yeah, I mean, I think today the players all fly. They all shoot the puck hard. They all fly, and even the big guys. But back when I played, there were some players that were
shitty.
slow and you know, conditioning wasn't as important as it is today. So guys were playing a little overweight. Yeah. You know, some guys' shots were, you know, just horrific. But there's a story about my brother practicing in Vancouver, and he was getting shit from Pat Quinn because he's normally really fast. Jeff was really fast, and they're doing laps.
Right.
And he's like, freaking blows the whistle and says, Quartz, fucking dogging it out here. You're fucking dogging it out here. And, you know, so-and-so's in front of you. Like, Dana Merson would not be a fast skater.
Right.
And so he thought he was dogging it. And Jeff said, oh, yeah. And he took off his practice sweater, and he had a 20-pound weight vest on. Yeah. Just to get a harder workout in, you know. How many guys think like that? But Jeff was one of those guys that super fit. Anyways, he took the vest off. He said, okay, start the drill again, and he lapped everybody. You know, the slow guys, when you did laps, would be all over guys, like especially the rookies, saying, freaking slow down or I'm going to freaking chop your ankles or whatever. So what you would see if you did, we used to push the nets up from the hash marks and then we'd do laps. And you'd see the young guys flying, but they would go further so that they wouldn't embarrass the other guys. So they were still going really, really fast, but they would go the longer route instead. And then the older fat guys would go behind the net where these young guys would be flying around below the hash marks and stuff. Yeah, yeah. You have to earn your crown to be able to rip people. So when you're young, the smart thing to do is get made fun of and laugh at yourself. And if you do that, you'll last a long time. But if you're cocky, you're in for a miserable ride because the older guys are going to give it to you.
Yeah. It's called, Russ, it's called company golf. All right. Don't show the other guy. Don't show your boss up. Don't show the client up. And do not show a veteran up when you're coming into camp.
Yeah. Otherwise, your rookie meal is going to be very expensive.
Matrix, big listener to the show. Rusty, players talk today about knowing who is on the ice with them for safety. In your era, there were far more goons and hacks. Did you just need to go out assuming any danger zone plays would make you vulnerable to headhunting?
I don't know about the headhunting part, but when I was playing, if you gave, you better be ready to receive or drop the gloves. So I didn't give a lot because I didn't want to fight. The other tough players on the team would try to get you off your game, and then our tough players would recognize that, and then the battles would begin. and the physical play amongst those players would happen, or fights. And then it would allow the offensive players then to go do their thing. So it was a fun era. I mean, they call it the Chuck Norris division, right? Back when, you know, Detroit, Minnesota, and Toronto. I loved it when we played Detroit and the freaking tough guys. Like, we'd have four or five dressed a game, and so would they, and they would all scrap. And then it was like, okay, let's play hockey. and you got so much ice time because there'd be 10 guys in the penalty box.
Right.
Five right, on each side. So we'd only have 15 skaters. I loved it. And, you know, most honest tough guys weren't out to get me. They tried to get me off my game. They weren't going to fight me, but they would try to, you know, hit me or whatever and get me off my game. But then, you know, Wendell Clark would step in and Bob McGill, and, you know, it was some crazy games. But I mean, definitely it's intimidating when at times, but you can't, you know, I always say that anybody who plays in the NHL is tough, whether they're a fighter or not. Like, Wayne Gretzky is freaking tough. He took a beating when he played. Not a lot of guys could catch him. But he still took a beating at different times in his career. He's not a physical player. He's not a fighter. But Wayne Gretzky's tough. You have to have some sort of toughness to play hockey, whether you can fight or not.
Rusty, very good. Mike Innes, final question here, Russ. When was the moment, Russ, that you fell in love with Jungle?
Oh, that's nice, huh? Isn't that a nice... God.
A little weird.
Yeah, I can't foresee the future, so I can't answer that question.
Anyway, Rusty, great show. Before we go, we're gonna end the show off with I mentioned it at the top that I found a guy who you told me was your greatest fan, and he followed you in Toronto. He ended up going to Montreal because he went to school there later, and he followed you. He talked about how he tracked you down, how he's tracked down other guys like Rick Tocchet. He tells a story about it. I talked to him yesterday on the phone, and we spent about 10 or 15 minutes, and he's a totally interesting guy.
Yeah.
And the stuff that he did, to the lengths he went to, I threw it out on my social media. What are the greatest lengths you've gone to meet your favorite player or get an autograph? And I'm gonna bring some of that to the show next week. There were so many responses I had, but this guy, the length he went to get inside the dressing room, which actually worked for a Stanley Cup final, and he's your biggest fan. So I'm gonna bring on Moshe Zizel. Is that right, Moshe? Does that sound right?
Yes, that sounds right. Moshe Zizel. Yes.
A good Irish guy, huh?
Yeah, good Irish.
So tell me about this whole thing, because we did talk on the phone a couple of months ago, and you are the truest, purest, biggest Russ Courtnell fan. Is that right?
I don't know any other big, huge ones, but I consider myself, you know, I think in the days, the biggest Courtnell fan. I think everybody knew me as Little Russ. So that's what the Montreal Canadian players like Svoboda and the other guys would come and say, "Hey, Russ, Little Russ is here. He wants to get into practice at the Verdun Arena or at the Montreal Forum." So that's how the guys knew me.
Right. So how did this whole attraction to Russ start, and how did you first meet? Explain that to me.
Well, early on when Russ, the first year he was on the Maple Leafs, I was a crazy hockey fan. I would, you know, go down to hotels when I was 9 years old, and you'd go to right. the Hilton Harbor Castle or those hotels and wait for autographs. Anyways, the first year Russ is on the team, they're writing an article in the Toronto Star, right. how he's adjusting to life in Toronto, you know, being from British Columbia. And they wrote he was living at a family named the Garys.
Yeah.
So I went to the Toronto phone book. Right. I took it out, and I called every single Gary in the Toronto phone book looking for Russ Courtnell. And I
seriously,
finally,
seriously.
Yeah, and there weren't that many. There were probably between, I don't remember exactly, but there were probably between 10 and 15. And I just said, "Is Russ there?" You know, not to make it. And finally, the lady goes, "Oh, 1 minute, please." And he came to the phone, and you know, that's how he, I think, became my favorite guy, because I would call him after a good game on a Sunday, you know, 2 o'clock, and they played the Blues or the North Stars the night before, and we'd speak about the game. And
right.
So as a little kid, you're 13 or 14 years old, and this player takes the time out to speak to you, you know, you become a big fan. Or that's how I really got to become a Russ Courtneau fan.
Right. How did you initially hook into Russ? What was it that you saw?
Well, he took my call, and he was the seventh pick in the draft. And the Leafs were so bad then, you know, they had such a terrible team, you know, any ray of hope, you'd get excited. And he was a high draft pick. He was fast.
Right.
He was little, he was exciting. You know, he was the future. So, you know, he was the player that the Leafs were hanging their hat on, and it was exciting to, you know, get to know him. I would go down at that point to the Centennial Arena where the Leafs practiced on Finch, and I would wait outside, like freezing, like in 30 below zero, you know, to get some stupid autographs of some Maple Leafs. And Russ would always come out, and he would always come over, hey, how you doing, this and that, you know. And when you're a little kid, that's even when you're 15, 16, and there's 20 people waiting, and looks at you and he says hello, you know, that for somebody that age, that's the greatest feeling in the world, that, you know, this player is recognizing you out of the whole crowd. So that's how I really became a Russ fan. When he got traded from the Leafs to Montreal, that's a famous story where I still have it somewhere in my house, the Le Journal de Montreal.
Yeah.
He got traded. Everyone knew I was the biggest Courtneau fan, and I was in a school in Montreal. And a guy walks up to me and he goes, the Canadians just got Courtney. And I go, you're joking around. And he goes, no, they got Courtney for John Cordick. And I'm going, no way. Anyways, I found out it was true. So I took a train down to the Montreal Forum at the time. And I right. still remember they were playing that night, the Canadians.
So you're still living in Toronto when this happened?
No, I'm in Montreal. I went to school in Montreal in 1986.
Okay.
And I go down to the Montreal Forum and it's at night. And they're all the reporters, I don't know all, there were about 7-8 reporters waiting outside for the newest member of the Canadiens to walk in. And there's a press entrance there.
Sure.
And I'm waiting there. And all of a sudden he looks at, you know, he comes in and he looks at me, and I was the only face he knew. So he right. gives me like a high five, like a little hug. And people are looking at me like, who is this guy? That, you know, the new guy in the Canadiens is looking at, like, where did you come out of?
Right.
And they asked me how I got there. Now, in Montreal, the subway is called the Metro, but I said train because I wasn't French-Canadian. So they asked me, you know, how do you know Russ? I go, I'm from Toronto. I took the train down. They thought I took the train down from Toronto to Montreal. So the next day in Le Journal de Montreal, the headlines were just like John Cordick has his fans, you know, Russ Courtneau has his fans, and they wrote right. that my name came all the way down from Toronto to the Montreal Forum to greet Russ Courtneau when he came into the Forum. It was pretty funny because it was a 10-minute train, you know, some metro ride. But they made it like it was a 4-hour ride to see the Russ.
Right. Is it really true that Russ had said to me, you're such a big fan of Courtneau that you changed your name to Russ?
Well, I had a Hebrew name, Moshe, so it's not the easiest name to say.
I guess that. I so, guess
but
it
all
was
the
Hebrew.
Players knew me, all the players, like when I would get into the practice, they would go, oh, look who's here. Little Russ is here. So, you know, when I had to pick an English name, you know, enough people called me Russ by that time. It was a pretty easy choice for me to make.
So how did you get into practice?
Oh, I used to have different things, but I had I was very, very dangerous with the phone in the old days, and with I once decided that I have, how do you get a press pass? And in the old days, you would call up the team and you would say, you know, you're from, you know, X newspaper and you want to come to the game, and they say, okay, write me a letter, send me a fax, and tell me when you want to come, and we'll get back to you.
Right.
So the first time I was like a naive Canadian, and I didn't know anything about it. I knew everything about sports, but not about American sports writers.
Right.
And I decided I was going to go to a Blue Jay game in the press credential. Now, at the time, there was a paper in the United States called The National. It was around right. for 2-3 years. It was only a sports paper.
Right.
So I sent them that I was doing a project on them. They sent me back stationery. I copied the stationery, and I wrote, I'm coming to the Blue Jay game. I want to pass. My name is Mike Lupica. Now, Mike is probably from the biggest writers, but I have no idea. So I write the Blue Jays, fax them a letter, and they say, no problem. I still remember it was the Kansas City Royals playing. And I go to the game, and before I go, I tell my brother, you don't believe it. I'm going to a Blue Jay game. I got a press pass. I'm going to be in the locker room. I'm going to be in the dugout.
Right.
I said, my name is Mike Lupica. My brother tells me, when you get arrested, because Mike Lupica is the biggest writer in the state, please call me.
Yeah.
So I go to the game, and I got those, probably the guy's 80 years old. He's the guy giving out the pass. And I quickly turned around my pass that you shouldn't see the name because I didn't want anybody to, ask. And, I got into the game, and happened to be George Brett hit a cycle, single, double, triple homer. It was his second in his career. And I'm sitting there with my $8 Radio Shack tape recorder, the one that you have to press the red and the black button to record at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking questions in the front of the line. And, I got into Stanley Cup championship games with a fake credential. I stopped doing the National after a while because that I caught on. I used to do the Jerusalem Post. And I would do it Friday night, so they would, like the NFL was, the games were on Sunday. So if I would send it late Friday, they were closed for the Sabbath. So by the time they would call to confirm, nobody would pick up the phone. So they would just say, okay, just give him the pass. But I went to Stanley Cup games, which I still have the passes, World Series and NBA championship games with the pass. And then after a while, I got too old for it, and I got caught at a New York Yankee playoff game where I think they caught on to me. So I just said, enough is enough. And I started buying seats instead of going to the games for free.
So you come up, you use the most prolific sports writer for the newspaper, The National. And your press pass says eventually – when that ran its course, then you said you're from the Jerusalem Post.
Yeah, the Jerusalem Post. I had their stationery. I had one guy that said he would vouch for me there if they called, because he didn't care. What did he care? He's thousands of miles away. You want to go to the game? I became friendly with him. Go to the game.
Sure.
I remember when Monica Seles got stabbed. So her first match was in Toronto.
Right.
And everybody wanted passes. And the next day in the Toronto Sun, they were saying how, big the match was going to be. They were all, as far as Tel Aviv, Israel, they're asking for a press credential to the match. And that was me. That I do remember.
Right. So all these years that have passed, and you've this is award-winning stuff here, by the way, Russ, or Moshe, or whatever I should call you. So you must have some great stories of getting into the locker room and being able to. Who did you interview? Like, you got into the Stanley Cup final, but did you get into the locker room as well?
Yes, I got into Detroit. I got in about four or five games, different games, but I was there when Konstantinov was in Washington when Detroit won the Stanley Cup. I was there.
Right.
I was there when they won, and I remember smacking Fedorov on the back, and nobody was looking at you because everyone was running around. And
sure.
It was.
So you sneak into the dressing room, and what do you do when you're in there? Who did you talk to? How did that go once you got in there?
You know what? Everyone's just happy and running around, and I don't even remember if there were many interviews, but I'll tell you, in the first game of the Stanley Cup, Philly-Detroit, so I got – before the first game, they have the press conference, and Eric Lindros is up there. And, I'm sitting there, and I little guy, and, everyone's asking these big questions. And I turn, and I raise my hand, and they pick on me, and I go, Eric, when you were growing up on Glencairn Avenue in Toronto, did you ever imagine being in this situation? And he looks at me like, who is this guy? What is going on over here? And then he came up to me after the whole thing. He says, how do you know? I grew up right next to you. I know where you live. Right. You know what I mean? But it was when you got into the championship game, there's so many guys just, there was champagne and everyone was just happy. No one was looking at you. Do you belong? Do you not belong? No one cares about
right.
it. You know what I mean? It's just, it's a lot of fun.
Okay. So tell me this. One of my good friends, he won his first game here, is Rick Tocchet, coach in Arizona. They pulled it off 4-3. We got to go. But I want to hear this. So you got a Rick Tocchet story.
Yeah, Rick Tocchet. So Rick Tocchet was one of my first I don't know what you call it, but Rick Tocchet came
into the league. One of your first stalking victims. Let's go with that.
Yeah, Rick Tocchet came into the league, yeah. And his father's phone number was listed in the phone book. I think his father was like, I still remember, it was with an F, like Finura or F. Anyways, back then, people who are 30 years old won't understand this, but when you got, there was no cell phone. Right. When you got a phone bill, a long distance bill, it came the time you called, sure. The date, how long, and where you called.
Sure.
So I called up Bell Canada, and I said, they asked me who I am, and I said, Mr. Tocchet, and I gave his number, and I go, what do you like? I go, you know, somebody was staying in my house, and they made a bunch of phone calls to Philadelphia, and they want to pay for them, but I can't find my bill, the itemized bill. Can you please give me the numbers that were made? Oh, sure, Mr. Tocchet. And they start listing 215 numbers, and I know that's Rick Tocchet's number, and I'm just writing it down. I then decided I was going to call him. And back then, you know, if somebody called you like that, they thought, I remember he was like, who is this? Like right away, and it was like, he hung up the phone. I think I scared him pretty bad.
Yeah, no shit.
We used to, you know, if you had a player's agent's number in those days, all you did was call up the Bell Canada and say you worked for the thing, and you needed to know if you knew who he represented and where the guy lived, you were able to get his number. That's what we used to do in the old days.
Right, right. So you got his number, and then did you eventually?
I don't think he appreciated that I called.
did you get to talk to him at all, or did he just hung up?
Yeah, I think like a minute, but I think he was more startled. Like where'd you get my, like, you know, somebody calls you and they start, like a fan, you're going like, who is this guy? You know what I mean? If somebody, you know, today I would understand. They would think the guy's nuts. But back then there was no tracing. There was no caller ID. So, you know, you called him up, and if he was, you know, I don't think he appreciated that I called.
No,
but,
no, I could see that. Yeah. Tell me this, if you did it, if you're going to do it today, do you think you'd be able to sneak into a dressing room? Could you figure it out?
Today there's too many, you know, it's the computer age. It's much too, you know, much too tough to do what we used to pull off great pranks, right, on the phone. I remember we called the Colorado Rocky baseball team when they signed Charlie Hayes. Oh,
God. Right.
To a $3 million deal.
Right.
And we called him, and we called the team, and we told them that we were on the courts with Charlie, and he just, like, blew out his knee, basically. And they got the assistant, Bob Gephardt, got on the phone within 5 minutes, like, where are you? And I'm telling you, you know, we're on the courts, man. And like, I don't know where we are. Like, and well, where's Charlie, you know? And we're talking, oh, he's saying the word fluids coming from. And these guys were going crazy, right? And they must have picked up the phone to Charlie Hayes like 3 hours later and saying that he was drinking a martini in his house. So we used to pull off some good stuff, but today you couldn't do half the stuff. You'd get nailed in seconds.
Well, listen, Moshe, we're going to – Moshe. Moshe?
Moshe. 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 I see you know how to say it. You're good.
Moshe Zilzel.
Yeah, you can ask me anything you want about Rusty.
Okay.
If you want.
What's your biggest thing? Then we got to go. What's your biggest thing that Russ gave you?
Oh, he gave me a stick. He gave me tickets a couple times. He was always, he was just a nice, genuinely nice guy. I told you last time, I remember calling you in the off season when he would be home, and I'd put the quarters into the Bell Canada phone. And, you know, you try to get in as many seconds as you can, like 40 seconds left. You know, your call is about to be over.
Sure.
And you would just say whatever you could in the next 40 seconds to wish him luck on the upcoming season and hope you would see him. So, but he was always nice to me. Sticks, you know, the tickets he gave me a few times, you know, get me to the practices. So
cool.
Back then that was as good as gold.
Well, Moshe, this was great, buddy. We're going to get you on again. I'm sure you've got a million stories, but it's the reason I brought you on today is I threw it out there on Twitter and my social media about what lengths would you go to meet your star or get something signed or wait to get a picture or something like that. And this may take the cake. We may not have to interview anybody else because this is a big one.
So. I got the media passes to back it up, so I still they have my picture on it even. So
You send me those, okay? I want to see those pictures. We're going to put them up. Why don't you go?
No problem.
Get off the phone and go scam somebody else for the afternoon, okay? You're really good at it. Okay, brother. Take care. So, Rusty, there it is. How about a guy faking letterhead to try and get a press pass, and somehow he convinced everyone he was from the Jerusalem Post to get it?
That's so good.
Wasn't he great? Yeah, he's That's fantastic. So good. Okay, Rusty, another show in the books. We're going to be back next week with another episode of the Suspendables with more and more stuff. Enjoy the hockey, folks. Rusty, you and I will talk about some games next week, and we're not into breaking them down, but we'll talk about a bunch of shit that happens. Yeah. So, carry on, Rusty. Have a good week, man.
You too.
The Suspendables is a weekly hockey series with Jim Jerome in Edmonton and Russ Cortinel in L.A. Follow The Suspendables on Facebook and Twitter. Reach us at thesuspendables@yahoo.com. And of course, we appreciate you sharing this podcast with your group of friends.